This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, we asked Ken Rudin about the race for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate in Florida and the news that Congresswoman Corinne Brown had thrown her hat in the ring.
I did not know that.
Really?
No.
Stick around. We'll see what Ken knows about the barn burner in Virginia, the brouhaha over the Sotomayor hearings, and the Palin puzzle. Would she speak? Would she show up? It's Wednesday, and time for an uncertain edition of The Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider. Ah!
Republicans hauled in more than $14 million at a Washington fundraiser. Sarah Palin waves. Newt Gingrich headlines. The Democrats put Sonia Sotomayor on the fast track. A coup in the state Senate in Albany, and the cold cash case goes to trial in Washington. Later, political reporter Richard Wolff joins us. He had extraordinary access to Barack Obama's campaign and wrote about it in a new book, Renegade, The Making of a President. But first, it's the political junkie. Ken, what's today's trivia question?
Hi, Neil. I did not expect that introduction. Thank you so much.
As always.
Well, the news is, as every political junkie knows, that Kim Jong-il, and of course, I didn't know of North Korea announced that he would probably transfer powers eventually to his son, that Kim Jong-il succeeded his father.
Now, Kim Il-sung.
Exactly. And now the situation of somebody succeeding a father in American politics is not unusual.
Adams, Bush.
Right. Well, I mean, right now, Ron Paul's son is running for the Senate in Kentucky. Joe Biden's son, of course, is going to probably run for the Senate in Delaware. Dennis Hastert, the former speaker, his son just announced he's going to run for Congress. But if we're talking about the three Kim Jong-il families, I don't know what's the Kim family. Okay, the last family with three generations in the United States, of course, of statewide elected officials. Who are they?
So if you think you know the identity of America's three-generation political dynasty, the most recent statewide office is the requirement here. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And, of course, the person with the first answer wins a fabulous no prize. But let's start in Virginia this week, Ken, where State Senator Creed Deeds won the Democratic primary in the governor's race against two better-known names.
Well, it's not so much that he won because there was clearly momentum on Deeds' behalf. I guess perhaps it started with a Washington Post editorial a few weeks back, and most people don't think that editorials matter that much.
Endorsements may matter that much.
But the fact that he won with 50% of the vote against one, Terry McAuliffe, who had raised $7.5 million, who's well-known for his stewardship of the DNC, worked on the Clinton campaigns, both the Hillary and Bill Clinton campaigns, and Brian Moran, who was, you know, a longtime leader in the House of Delegates in Virginia. He was pro-gay marriage. The progressives were apparently backing him. But Creed Deeds, who's pro-gun, which is not a popular position in the Democratic Party, or at least not the Democratic Party.
In Virginia, Jim Webb.
That's exactly it. And maybe for that many reasons, Creed Deeds may be a much stronger candidate than Republicans expected in November. But Deeds won 50%, and he won basically around the whole state.
And we're going to hear a clip of his acceptance speech last night, his victory party, where he immediately went on the attack against his Republican opponent.
There's a very stark choice of whether Virginia continues to move forward in the tradition of Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, or whether we move backwards with the disastrous economic and social agenda of Bob McDonnell and George W. Bush.
His last name is McDonnell and George Bush, apparently. But anyway, Mr. McDonnell made comments of his own. He was, of course, had already secured the Republican nomination and took a more humorous approach.
It was a tough primary, and I have to say, I'm sorry to see it end. And Cree, after your victory, I'd say take a break. You deserve it. Long vacation. Relax for a few months. Take some time off.
And that election, of course, comes up in November. But this is a race that is always a bellwether of national politics, except when it isn't.
Exactly. But first, let's say that these guys know each other. 4 years ago, they ran against each other for state attorney general. McDonnell beat Deeds by 323 votes and have 2 million cast. So it's obviously going to be, I expect to be a very close race in November as well. And we always like to make these big pronouncements that, well, you know, we saw what happened in 1993 when Republicans won New Jersey and New York City with Giuliani and Virginia, and then in 1994 Newt Gingrich took over. So, but often it's just very isolated things. It may not be a referendum on Barack Obama. It may not be a sign that the Republican Party is in the middle of a comeback or the beginning of a comeback. But the fact is, there are two governorships this year in New Jersey and Virginia. Republicans would love to win both, and they'd love to have those bragging rights, even if it only lasts for a short time.
Well, speaking of Newt Gingrich, here's the scenario, as I understand it. The congressional Republicans holding a fundraising party. They invite the vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, to be the keynote address.
A while back.
Right. And her staff replies, well, she's not sure she can make it. So they say, all right, Newt Gingrich, would you give the keynote address? Then Sarah Palin suddenly arrives in the state of New York to celebrate the purchase of Alaska by the Seward family. So she was up in Auburn, New York for that. Showed up at Yankee Stadium to watch a ball game with Rudy Giuliani. And then was she going to speak? Was going to go on. And then finally, we did get the event night before last.
Sarah Palin's problem is, well, I don't know, there's a lot of problems, but one of them may be that she's listening to two different ears. You know, remember there was a scene in Animal House where a guy is listening to an angel and a devil about what to do in a frat party.
Usually the devil wins in that picture.
Well, I don't think she knows who she's listening to. And there are some people say that she should be more of a Washingtonian. She should be in the Capitol. She should be hobnobbing with all the political elites. The other said, look, you know, she's in a tough race. She has a tough economic budgetary problems in the state of Alaska. She still has to decide whether she's going to run for a second term as governor in 2010. So maybe she shouldn't be going around nationwide. And so she gave mixed signals. A lot of people feel that if we're looking for a national leader, somebody not unstable but at least uncertain like that should not be the person we're looking to. The thing is, she was picked as John McCain's running mate when she really may not have been ready for it. And the question a lot of Republicans ask is she still ready for it? And she may not be.
And during the speech, the widely quoted comment from Newt Gingrich, almost an hour-long speech, said he is happy that Dick Cheney is a Republican. He's also happy that Colin Powell is a Republican, but the former Speaker of the House also took some shots at the Obama administration.
Despite every effort of the elite media to prop up Joe Biden and pretend he actually knows what he's doing, I felt looking at John McCain and Sarah Palin, this country would have been amazingly better off had they been in the White House.
And interesting, a poll coming out today about who Americans believe is the leader of the Republican Party. And guess what? They don't know.
Well, because all you're seeing are the Dick Cheneys, the Colin Powell, the Dick Cheneys, the Newt Gingrich, and even Rush Limbaugh. You see them on the Sunday talk shows. You see them on the front page of the newspapers. Part of it may be the liberal media elite that wants you to think that these are the Republican leaders of the Republican Party. But the truth is, there are no Republican standard bearers. As we get closer to 2012, we'll see more national leaders. But if you're looking at the Republican leadership in Congress, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, they are not the people who Republicans feel should be leading the party into the future.
I think we have some people on the line who think they know the answer to our trivia question this week, which was the most recent American dynasty, three generations in statewide office. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Ben's with us from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Hi. I was going to guess the Gores.
Gores, Albert Sr. and Albert Jr.
Exactly. Albert Sr. was a senator from Tennessee in the 1950s and until 1970, and of course Al Jr., but there is no third leg of that.
This could happen.
That's right. But there's only two.
All right. Nice try, Ben.
Maybe he was thinking of Leslie Gore, but I don't think that works.
I don't think so, no. Joe in Baltimore.
Hi.
Go ahead, Joe.
How about the Bush family?
Bush family, of course, Bush 41 and Bush 43.
Well, actually, you could start with Prescott Bush, who was a senator from Connecticut, and he was elected a senator. But his son, George Herbert Walker Bush, was not elected. He ran to the Senate twice in Texas, but did not win. Now, Jeb Bush
did not win statewide,
even though he ran for the Senate
twice. Boy, that's a technicality.
The grandson, George W. Bush, was elected governor of Texas. Jeb was governor of Florida. But the middle guy, George H.W. Bush, was not elected statewide, even though he tried twice.
Nice try, Joe.
Thanks.
Awfully close. Awfully close. Mm. Let's see if we go next to David. David with us from Enid, Oklahoma.
That would be the Simpson family of Wyoming, Millward, Al, and Colin.
Well, I know Millward Simpson was governor and senator from Wyoming, and of course Al Simpson was a senator from Wyoming. Who was the third Simpson you're talking about?
Colin Simpson.
And who is he?
Colin is Al's son, and he's currently part of the state legislature.
Right, but he's not elected to statewide office.
Statewide office, David.
Okay.
You stumped Ken, but you still didn't get it right.
And so with a wrong Simpson answer, my only answer is no.
Let's go to, this is Jeremy. Jeremy with us from Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, I'm going to guess the Herseth family in South Dakota. Stephanie is presently a congresswoman. Her grandfather, Ralph, was governor, and her grandmother, Lorna, was Secretary of State.
And Ken?
That is the correct answer. That is the correct answer. That is the most recent of the three dynasties.
Ding, 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 ding,
the Herseth
ding, ding.
Family in South Dakota.
Jeremy, hang on. We're going to get your information from you. You're going to win a fabulous no-prize T-shirt, which will be mailed out to you on the stipulation you take a digital picture and mail it back to us so Ken can put it on his website.
Most certainly.
All right, Ken.
And, of course, if he's from South Dakota, he could win a T-shirt if he could be among his peers.
Talking about comedy, what's going on in Albany, New York, where the Democrats, for the first time in, 43 years, won a majority in the state
in
Senate,
November.
And all of a sudden, they're out on the lawn.
This is very bizarre, and it's going to be take a roadmap to get you there, but I'll do the best I can. What happened 2 days ago is that there were 30 Republicans in the Senate, and they decided to have a roll call vote on the leadership, and they got two disaffected Democrats, one state senator from the Bronx, one from Queens, to vote with the Republicans, and suddenly the Republicans had a majority in the leadership in the state Senate, 32-30. Now, what's interesting is that the two Democrats they picked up, one of them is under indictment for money laundering, and the other one has been accused of slashing his girlfriend with a pane of glass. But besides that, they are very
what a stable majority.
Exactly. But the Republicans will take it when they can get it, and so the Democrats who've been waiting 43 years, as you say, for the leadership in the state Senate are now out the door. They have turned off the lights in the state Senate. They have not given the Republicans the keys. They're trying to see if there's some kind of legal action they can take. But it's very bizarre that the Republicans are talking about reforming state government, and the two Democrats they pick up are very
questionably
suspect.
Ethically.
Yes.
And also an indictment, in a way, of the leadership of the accidental governor of the state of New York, David Paterson, whose opinion polls he's down in the teens.
He's in big, big trouble. And there's talk about, of course, Andrew Cuomo, the state attorney general, running against him. But Charlie Rangel, who's African-American, suggested that Cuomo should not run against the state's first black governor. That'll be interesting.
Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us. Up next, an inside look at the man who became President Obama. Richard Wolff will join us to talk about his book, Renegade, The Making of a President. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Political Junkie Day. It's Wednesday. Ken Rudin is with us, as always, NPR's political editor and prolific blogger. You can read his latest at npr.org/junkie. For the rest of the hour, we want to focus on the making of a president. While covering the Obama campaign, journalist Richard Wolff received an offer he couldn't refuse. The candidate himself asked a somewhat surprised Wolff if he'd like to write a book about him in the manner of Theodore White and his iconic chronicle of JFK's campaign, The Making of the President, 1960. Well, he didn't refuse, and the book is now out. Renegade, The Making of the President, lays out the inner workings of a presidential campaign by a then improbable candidate, but also reveals a great deal about the life and the character of the man. And so we want to hear from you. If we learned about the character of Barack Obama in the course of this campaign, what did you learn about him? What was the moment that brought Barack Obama's character into focus for you? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. And Richard Wolff has been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in.
Neil, it's my pleasure. I'm a big fan of this show, so happy to be here.
Oh, well, thanks for that. And did you wonder if then-Senator Obama was serious when he asked you to write this book?
I did, and he may have wondered whether I was serious because I told him it was a stupid idea. Actually, it was an offer I refused. I thought that nobody would want to read campaign books ever again because they kind of had died. Theodore White established the genre, and publishers had increasingly turned away from them. Then I went to the back of the plane and thought about it for a few weeks and talked to friends and realized that I actually was the idiot and went back to him kind of sheepishly and said maybe there was actually a book in it.
And if he'd lost, direct a DVD, right?
You know, people I think would have been interested in his story, win or lose. Of course, they're more interested in now.
The book, your thesis really is, this was a person we, the American public, did not know a great deal about when this campaign started.
That's right.
That we learned about him in the cauldron of the long primary campaign and then the general election that followed. Is there a moment where his character came into focus for you?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is a book about the character more than the campaign. This is campaign as biography. And it wasn't just that he was new to the scene, that he had actually a thin resume, as Hillary Clinton used to say all the time.
Yes. But
that the campaign was the biggest thing he had ever done. So it tested him, and it revealed a character that I think he and certainly his aides and his friends didn't really know he had. One conversation did stick out with me, though. This was early on in the primaries. The primaries had already begun at this mm-hmm. point, not the long year before anything really started. And we were talking about the battle with the Clintons. And he said to me, you know, I could walk away from all of this stuff. I could just go back and be in Chicago and I'd be happy. And I frankly was incredulous. I said, you know, don't be ridiculous. How could you go back or teach law and just be with your kids? He said, yeah, I could. I don't think she could, meaning Hillary Clinton. But he said, you know, now they've annoyed me. Now I really want to win. And to me, there was this constant contradiction with this guy. And this makes it hard to write a book because there's no single thesis. None of us, mm-hmm. I guess, are pure, sort of linear, straight and true. But here's a guy who could walk away, or at least thought he could walk away, but also was so competitive that it drove him on. And the tension between the two, the restlessness and the sort of self-confidence and self-comfort, struck me as actually a fascinating story we weren't really seeing played out through the primaries.
Hmm. Ken?
Richard, I mean, I agree with you. It's a fascinating story. Whether he won or lost, it would have been a fascinating story. And yet, as I watched the campaign, personally, as I watched the campaign, as I watched him win Iowa, as I watched him win South Carolina, I still thought, perhaps as late as early March, mm-hmm. that Hillary Clinton was going to still win the nomination. When did you see that this guy had really had a shot at it?
I see. I sort of saw it quite early on. I admit that when this first popped up, everyone was sort of wrestling over the front runners, Clinton and Giuliani. I thought, for a start, it would be a fascinating thing to watch. But when I went, this is early 2007, when I went to see him on his announcement tour in Springfield and then through Iowa, there were a couple of things that stood out for me. I'd covered Bush in 2000 and then Dean and Kerry in 2004. It struck me that he had a connection with crowds that was quite remarkable. He had a comfort with them. And then as I was researching stories for my then employer, Newsweek, he had a command of policy that went well beyond the talking points. He had thought through not just the substance, but how he was going to reach people. The power of storytelling, I come back time and again in the book about, it's not just he knows how to give a speech or that he knows how to write a good book, but that connecting people through stories, whether it's in a speech or in a book, or door-to-door, the organizers who were telling stories, telling their own story, telling his story, door-to-door in Iowa, was a powerful political tool. And I just don't think people in Washington understood that this was not just a way to tell a story. It was a way to build a campaign, an organization, and get the connections going. That's why people turned out to vote. It's because they felt a connection to him.
And he didn't apparently understand that himself. You talk about early on in Iowa, an early organizer signing on with him and looking at the crowds reacting to him as if he
that's
was
right.
a rock star and says, do you understand what's going on? He said, I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. This is Steve Hildebrand, a political operative who knew Iowa incredibly well. Actually, comes back to South Dakota because that's where he's from. And he saw these people who had read the book and felt passionately about the memoir Dreams from My Father, and he was just blown away at how people were responding. You can't create that. You can spend a lot of money and never get close to it, as I think Mitt Romney found.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Our guest is Richard Wolff, the author of Renegade, The Making of a President, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. When was the moment that the character of Barack Obama came into focus for you? We'll begin with Marcus, and Marcus is with us from Williamston in North Carolina.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. The moment, I think a lot of people would agree with me on this, was when he gave the speech concerning Reverend Wright. I remember my father, my wife is, her father is white and her mother is black. And I remember my father-in-law telling me about co-workers that heard that, white people that heard that speech and started crying. And he came to me, he said, when he downloaded the video or read it or whatever, he cried. And when I saw it, it just was, I knew that he was the guy that was could relate to both worlds in America, white and black. And he really was fair-minded in his view, and I knew that we'd never seen anything like that in politics, or, I mean, just in period, really.
In the unlikely event anybody's forgotten that Reverend Jeremiah Wright, whose church the Obamas attended for many years, who had married the Obamas, and then videos were uncovered of him making inflammatory racial comments, and then Barack Obama made, I think, what will be regarded as an historic speech in Philadelphia.
Yes, he did, and an incredibly unconventional one. There's a reason I call the book Renegade, and not just because that's his Secret Service name. He did things that sane candidates just don't do. And in fact, he wanted to give a race speech from a very early stage. He had this speech in mind, and his aides said it was never the right time. And then, of course, Reverend Wright came along. It was a moment of great peril. And the debate was curtailed. It wasn't about, you know, should they have the speech. He was going to do it. He wrote it on his own at the end of long days of campaigning and taping ads, finished it at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. On the day he delivered the speech, he does leave things to the last minute. Mm-hmm. By the way, this is a constant theme with this guy. It worked in a sense. Very nuanced speech, not many sound bites, and it was actually quite hard to pull a sound bite from that speech.
Yeah, tell me about it.
And Reverend Wright did come back, as I explain in the book. Made more inflammatory comments. One thing I will just add that people haven't really noticed in the book, because he obviously does speak about race in a very unusual way, unusual for American politics in a sense, because he, as one of his mentors told me, he doesn't do ethnic politics very well. That's why he lost his race for Congress in Chicago in 2000. But here's a guy who, at the same time, draws his inspiration, Malcolm X. There's a chapter of the book called Barack X. Mm-hmm. And not Malcolm X as we in the mainstream might think of him, the sort of religious and racial firebrand, but the self-discipline, the storytelling that made Malcolm X compelling.
A man who could reinvent himself.
Who could reinvent himself. I think, everyone looks at the race speech and they says, here's the big conciliator, the man who can pull the country together. But he draws something else from the African-American tradition, and it's important to recognize both sides of this.
You also, and Marcus, thanks very much for the call. You also point out something else in the book. It's the luck of timing. Had these speeches come out earlier in the campaign, they might have been lethal.
Yes, and he asked right at the start. There was a Rolling Stone story that touched on the sermons. He said to his own people, his research people, go scrub these speeches. Dirty secret was he really wasn't in church that much, which is kind of embarrassing. If you've written a chapter of your book saying about why politicians should be in touch with faith communities, he was out campaigning. He had young kids, as he told me. He wasn't in church very much. He said to his research people, go do this work. They never did it. Just slipped through the cracks. If those sermons had emerged before Iowa, I think many of the people in the campaign were convinced it could well have sunk them before they ever started.
Ken?
There's something in your book also that talked about how Michelle Obama was not crazy about his 2004 Senate race, perhaps his 2000 congressional race as well. And a lot of the reviews of your book have talked about the state of their marriage.
Yeah, to a surprising degree. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised because people are fascinated with the couple and the family. There's no question that they have worked at their marriage and that one of the key concerns for their friends as they debated whether or not to run and it was a joint decision. They were actually quite hesitant about it. One of the things the friends wanted to know was, were they strong enough to deal with it? Because she hadn't liked or enjoyed at the 2000 campaign. In fact, it had caused a lot of pressure at a time when they had young kids and they financially were pretty weak. 2004, she had some involvement, but not much. She never really liked politics. She liked policy and public service. So she had to throw herself into this. And I think it's a testament to where they're at right now, that they've worked at it, and that they said to their friends, look, don't worry about us. We just have to make sure that the girls are okay. She wanted to know from the political advisors to begin with, could he take weekends off when he was campaigning? And they said, absolutely not. So they had some adjustment to go through, and that first year of campaigning was very painful for him, for the family. It took them a long time to get used to this.
Hmm. Here's an email from Mike in Fort Wayne, Indiana. My light bulb moment on Obama's character was last summer when he refused to support a gas tax holiday with Clinton and McCain. He called it out as political pandering, which it was.
It was a defining moment for them. They had really got into a rut. After they had that extraordinary February of winning state after state after state, then they went through Pennsylvania, the 6-week slog to defeat. There was Reverend Wright, the bitter comments. And they lost in Texas and Ohio just before that. It was a really rough period, which went on and on and on and on. The gas tax thing popped up. And they were running, frankly, a very conventional campaign. They'd run out of steam, run out of ideas. They couldn't do the big arena speeches anymore, partly because Hillary Clinton had intimidated them with that no more of the big rallies, that kind of thing. And then the gas tax thing came up. And it was the candidate himself, before they tested it, looked at the polls, who said, this isn't going to work. This is pandering. We're not going to do it. And it reminded them that they were trying to run an unconventional campaign. They got all cautious about it. And then, of course, they polled it and tested it. But it was one of those, again, a renegade moment where he showed that he was not part of the establishment and the conventional wisdom. And it saved them. It's what got them through North Carolina. They won big there, and they just lost in Indiana. But they thought they were going to lose both, and they thought they were going to lose both because Reverend Wright made his comeback tour.
Richard Wolff, the author of Renegade, The Making of a President. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, of course, political junkie Ken Rudin is with us. Let's go to Leanne. Leanne with us from San Francisco.
Hi. I'd like to refer back to the relationship that you mentioned because that was my light bulb moment. I met the Obamas. I had an incredible opportunity to meet them in Los Angeles. I believe this was just after they declared or just before. I met Michelle first and was absolutely delighted and impressed with her warmth and intellectual vigor. We had immediately had a political conversation about the possibility of the candidacy. And later in that evening, Michelle Obama spoke first. She was articulate, brilliant. But Barack stood up to speak, and what he said was, well, there really is only one person in the United States that if they were to declare their candidacy, I would probably have to pull back from this declaration, and that is Michelle Obama. And it was at that moment, and he seemed to that remark seemed to be very spontaneously and sort of a shared joy between them of mutual appreciation. I think having come from the generation where the personal is political, that generation of men and women in partnership, that was the moment. I thought that as a partnership, that I sort of moved from my appreciation of the Clintons and especially Hillary Clinton to the Obamas.
Interesting. Well, I think people were attracted by the family, by the relationship, for sure. They can also be quite competitive with each other. I mean, if there's anyone more competitive than him, it's her. In fact, he once told me they couldn't play card games with each other because she hated losing so much. Now, she could be tough on him. I mean, that was a very nice introduction he gave to her, or a thank you. And it's true, for the first year, her stump speech was much better than his. But after Texas and Ohio, when they blew it, they had their chance to seal the whole thing, she was so annoyed with their failure that she said, and I put this in the book, that unless they came up with a winning strategy, she would not go out and campaign again. Huh. And that ultimatum maybe is something that happens in marriages all across the country. But, you know, the relationship is surprisingly normal that way. And it's easy to look at the glossy images now, and it all seems distant and remote. But there are flashes like that where you think there's a bit of needle. They obviously love each other. But it is normal.
Leanne, thanks very much for the call. Ken?
Thank you.
Richard, you've seen him probably closer than anybody other than his family and his campaign staff. Is there anything you've seen since he became president that surprised you, or not disappointed you, but something you didn't expect, something out of character?
Well, I interviewed him in the Oval Office. This would be about February time. It was a first print interview he'd done. And he struck me as being even more tired than he was during the campaign. I mean, I think this has been a grind. The scale of the challenges, the number of things he's taking on. You know, he did talk in the campaign about wanting an impatient White House, and that's certainly what he has got. But one thing, if you're getting at the sort of policy question, is he left, is he right, has he disappointed people on the left in some way? I always thought if it weren't for his position on the war, his opposition to the war, a lot of people on the left would not have treated him the same way. I mean, you can't say you're going to unite America, red and blue America and United States of America, if you take only a progressive viewpoint. So he was always a figure of compromise and consensus. And that always meant some kind of disappointment for people in the base.
Interesting. You point out that during his, after he was elected to the Senate, a lot of the people in the base were disappointed.
They were, because he didn't go out there and campaign against the war. That's what they wanted. It didn't fit in with his strategic plan. I also just don't think that's the kind of politics he wanted to engage with. It wasn't just that he didn't want a high profile, although that's one thing they were trying to do, lower this man's profile. They were getting heat from other members of Congress who didn't like the fact that he was so famous. And one of those people, frankly, was Joe Biden, who ended up as vice president. But
A very articulate and clean man, Joe Biden.
And smart, too.
Yes.
But he... His opposition to the war really carried him through a long way. So maybe people were hearing what they wanted to hear.
We're talking with Richard Wolff about the making of a president. More after we come back from a short break. What was your light bulb moment? What told you about the character of Barack Obama? Ken Rudin, our political junkie, is with us. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, political junkie Ken Rudin is with us, as he is every Wednesday, and we're talking with Richard Wolff. During the campaign, he spent nearly 2 years on the road with Barack Obama, the candidate. He details what he learned about the man who became president in his new book, Renegade. What did you learn about the character of the president during the long campaign? What was your light bulb moment? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. There's an excerpt from the book at the website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation that chronicles the final moments of the Obama campaign last November. That's at npr.org/talk. When you're a reporter covering a presidential campaign, it means long days and nights on the road, often no break for anniversaries or holidays or birthdays. Last September, aboard the Obama campaign plane, Barack Obama and a gaggle of campaign reporters helped Richard Wolff mark his birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
How old are you, Wolf?
22, he replied. Now President Obama joining in singing happy birthday to our guest Richard Wolff, then covering the Obama campaign. And given that, given the access that you had, did you worry about getting too close?
Well, that's a good question. But first of all, let me just say that tape clearly proves that you can get elected even if you can't hit the high notes.
or bowl.
Or the low boats, low notes. You know, the access question is interesting. Every journalist, whatever you cover, has to have some kind of access. If you're a police reporter, and I started out covering crime and that kind of thing, and small-town newspapers, you've got to know people. You've got to have sources. You've got to develop an understanding. And on a subject like this, I don't know how you can tell this story without having real insight into the substance, into the characters, especially a complex character like this. The question then isn't about access. It's about what you do with it and what the end product is like. And I think I would have done myself, the readers, and even the campaign a disservice by whitewashing the whole thing. There's a chapter in the book about failure. I think you learn a lot from failure, both as an observer and political insiders, too. I will say that when this book was first reported about, in leaked form, it was on Fox News. They found plenty of things to talk about, as has conservative talk radio, and I've done way more than a dozen interviews with those folks. The question here is it truthful? Is it honest? I didn't try to build him up or tear him down. I tried to probe him and analyze him and test him. And the reviews at the Post and the New York Times have certainly borne that out. You know, one thing that I love people's reaction to the book, but I have to say, as a sort of recovering reporter, one thing that really had an impact for me was Ben Bradley, who read, the legendary editor of the Washington Post, read the book in galley form. And if you know Ben Bradley, he's not only is he not a pushover, but he doesn't say anything he doesn't want to say. He called the book insightful, thorough, and straight. And that meant a lot to me.
Here's an email from David in Minneapolis. As an observer during the campaign, I was struck by how little we actually learned about Barack Obama himself in those months and how much rested on his charisma, as evidenced by his almost cult-like following. I heard over and over how people didn't know much about what his platform was, but knew that he stood for the ambiguous slogan of hope. It seems to me that politics is more about ideology and marketing rather than substance and fact.
Well, over 2 years, there was ample opportunity for people to get into debates and policy discussions. And often the candidate would enjoy them more than anything else. You know, when he was finding it really hard to be a candidate in the first year, they used to schedule more policy time. I mean, this is a wonkish character. And anyone who could ask him questions in town halls across the country, and remember, the primaries took them to pretty much every state, he would engage in those policy discussions. They were there. Now, granted, the media really does a terribly bad job of covering policy debates.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We're all guilty of that.
Oh, he's the editor.
But look, it was there if you were looking for it. And actually, I found that a lot of voters were looking for it. They were aware that this was a serious time. There were a number of different challenges. Again, you may not, if you only looked at it from the outside, you may have just seen hope and change and said that was it. But really, you didn't have to scratch very far, either on the internet or in person or following it in newspapers, wherever. The policy discussions were there. His policies weren't that new. I thought that it was very much consensus Democratic politics. But, you know, like them or not, he did talk about it a lot.
Let's get James on the line. James with us from Liberty, Missouri.
Yes, hello. I thought President Obama revealed his character best during the debates. When I was losing it, he didn't seem to. You know, John McCain's relentless accusations put down cheap shots. Mr. Obama always remained calm and very respectful, like they would be in the Senate. And that's when I thought his character was truly revealed. You know, they say character is what you do when no one's looking. Well, here he's before the world, and he always held whatever he... What I felt like saying, he never did say.
I think, James, you're talking about the third debate. The first two were awfully civil, but...
Yes, it was the third one. I think they wanted to get him riled, and nothing seemed to upset him.
Right. And look, response under fire is something voters should look for. I mean, if there's a stress test that means anything in these campaigns, it's precisely for that, as well as his response to the financial meltdown that was around the same time. This is practice, though. I mean, these debates are... he does have a cool demeanor. There is no question about that. And it's interesting to ask where that comes from. But in those debates, he had to, for instance, work on the tilt of his head. He used to look up a lot at sort of 45 degrees, and it looked a bit snooty. So they worked on making his head a little bit straighter and a little less supercilious. So there are little tricks they played like that. But the being cool under fire... is a study, and he has this very low heartbeat in his resting state. On the other hand, I have seen him get angry and annoyed and grumpy and impatient. Oh. He can be all of those things too.
I remember how it tanked Al Gore's campaign. They thought he was sort of mean.
The sighing. Yes.
George Bush was a little bit more amicable. We'd rather go with him. You know?
I only did that with Ken off mic. So. Okay, James, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. John in Sacramento emails, Obama doesn't strike me as a renegade, rather a typical politician, particularly adept at pandering. Why the title renegade?
Well, renegade is his Secret Service code name. I thought it was a useful start for the discussion of what this character is. There are lots of things that were really unconventional, also things that he did that were conventional. But the unconventional stuff, let's start from it. I mean, he didn't wait his turn. He had no name, or rather an alien name. He had no money, no real organization put together when he decided to run. He did things, like I said, that no sane candidate would do. He took his campaign overseas. What was he thinking? The logistical policy pitfalls are everywhere when you do that kind of thing. He took his convention speech outdoors. He rejected public finance, changed the way campaigns will be run forevermore. So he broke the rules repeatedly. In fact, they used to enjoy breaking the rules at the same time. Very competitive. If the rules could help him win, then he would chop back and forth. And those lines, when he would decide to be conventional, weren't always clear. You can only blame his staff so far for lapsing into a conventional campaign, because he could be risk-averse too. I think the combination of the two, the sort of cautious renegade, if you will, is what makes him successful. I guess otherwise you'd be a maverick.
Okay, and that's it. That was the other guy. Ken?
Two calls ago, they were talking about how Barack Obama was respectful and he didn't get angry. Did you ever have conversations with Obama about race and how race may have played in that kind of response? Because I saw a lot of media coverage saying, well, the last thing white America wanted to see was an angry black candidate.
Right.
Did you have conversations with that?
Lots of conversations about that. The race debate was something he was incredibly familiar with. It was one of actually the first cover stories I did about him. For a start, the parameters of the debate were something that he wasn't particularly happy with for a number of reasons. People used to call him, and still do, as a post-racial guy. He doesn't believe there is any such thing as a post-racial politics. He thinks that's naive. On the other hand, he doesn't speak the language of typical racial politics. And I think that's why the sort of angry black character, apart from the fact that it really didn't gel with who he was also kind of ridiculous for him. One of the early debates that I recount in the book is his dispute with Cornel West, who ended up being actually a backer of his. But Cornel West, obviously an academic, a brilliant, bombastic guy, criticized him early on for saying in his convention speech, the thing that launched him in 2004, talking about America as a land of opportunity, the optimism that he brings to talking about America, he found that alienating. He said that that was, in his own words, a Christopher Columbus experience. And wasn't shared by African-American voters who, as you remember, didn't actually support him until he really won in Iowa. And I think the way he speaks about race is actually not generally from an African-American perspective. He drew on that very rarely. His wife, on the other hand, did often do that. He was always aware of how different his register of language was in his conceptual view of racial politics was. But remember, he grew up with a white family. He grew up in Hawaii. And when we would talk about race, this is something that's actually quite common. His brother-in-law would talk about it, Michelle's brother. When you are upwardly mobile, African-American professional, Ivy League educated, or in his case, just, you know, gone to a number of elite schools, you've got to be able to cross different lines. They could be social. They could be racial. They could be within your own community. I mean, that was Michelle Obama's Princeton thesis about what was it like going to Princeton and then going back into your own community. This is an experience not just special to him. It's shared throughout a whole generation of successful upper middle class African American professionals, and it gives them an ease of transition and discussion if they can navigate this minefield that is useful for him politically, socially, and I think now as president.
NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is with us, as he is every Wednesday. Today, an extended conversation with Richard Wolff about his new book, Renegade, The Making of a President. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we'll try to get listener questions in these last 5 minutes. Jim, in West Sacramento, California, my light bulb moment for Barack Obama was when he announced that he would not limit his presidential campaign to public finance. That was when it became impossible for me to fool myself into thinking he was different from or better than any other slippery politician. I should add this, I'm a lifelong Democrat, consistently lambasted by my professional peers for being too liberal, and do still think Obama is a competent individual who will do his best. His best, unfortunately, is done in a context that permits casually making and breaking promises.
I think it was a totally slippery moment. It was a complete backtrack, and it came out of his desire to win. And they had planned for it from a very early stage. Again, as I explain in the book, it required them to think ahead a huge amount. What's interesting is that breaking public finance rules, taking the private money, allowed them to play politics differently. They could advertise a lot with positive messages, but as well as being negative.
They could run the two-track campaign. We talked a lot about that during the campaign. But there are written answers where he said, I will do my best.
They regretted writing them down. And it was a flip-flop. There is no question about it. It was an unprincipled move because they wanted to win, and it allowed them to do things other politicians had never done before. And I do think other candidates now will need their heads examined if they take public money.
Unless the public money has changed. Let's see if we can go now to Tony. Tony with us from Bar Harbor in Maine.
Thank you. Yes, I voted for Obama. I admit I voted for him because I thought he was an altruistic Machiavellian. I thought Rove and Cheney were negative Machiavellians. But I'm afraid Obama's too young. I think he's a young Carter, a young Kennedy. He's going to keep us in Pakistan, Afghanistan forever. I mean, I'm so disappointed that he's not doing what he told us he was going to do. Five years ago, they were saying we're going to be in Afghanistan without 500,000 troops. Why didn't he get that?
Well, he did campaign throughout about focusing on the war in Afghanistan, saying the loss of focus in Afghanistan led to the mistake in Iraq and that he would put more troops in Afghanistan. Tony, that's exactly what he's done.
He did. And by the way, I like the concept of an altruistic Machiavelli.
That's a good line.
That may be the title of the next book.
Yeah, I'm trying to... be my guest. I don't have time to write a book. I'm a cop. And so anyway, go ahead. Thank you.
All right, Tony. Thanks very much. Iraq, he also said he would pull out, and people are disappointed he's not done that quicker. The U.S. troops are scheduled to be out of Iraqi cities at the end of next month.
That was thoroughly debated, too. Remember Bill Richardson? Maybe you don't remember. I'm sure Ken does. But Bill Richardson said, a date's certain. They've got to be out by this point. He would never sign up to that. Mm-hmm. So all those warning signs were there. If again, people needed to listen closely, not just listen to what they wanted to hear.
Alan is with us from the president's hometown of Chicago.
Yes, hi. I am disappointed. I think an area where Obama has failed to deliver is with regard to gay issues and gay rights. And I'd like to know your take on his feelings, his personal feelings, if you have any sense of that, about gays and why he hasn't done anything or what he kind of promised to do or has insufficiently dealt with gay rights.
Well, he would talk about his gay friends a lot, but to me, the red flag in all of this was his position, his opposition to gay marriage. I mean, I think that was a warning sign to anyone who thought that this was going to be a sort of champion of gay rights from the beginning. And I don't think he's going to shift that position. So his rhetoric really didn't match what was going to be. If anyone thought this was a priority for him, it clearly wasn't.
Not so much gay marriage, but other issues like don't ask, don't tell. You know,
he did promise to change that.
He did, but I think gay marriage is a more live, more important statement of principle.
But that's the promise he made, and he hasn't done it.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I imagine he will come back to it now later. But their model right now is don't do what the Clintons did. Everything is shaped by the fact that they don't want to get into the mess that the Clintons did early on. I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back to that later. But again, it's just not a priority, and it wouldn't be a priority if you don't actually support gay marriage.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think there are issues that are very important that can be dealt with and should be dealt with if without dealing with gay marriage. And I think that this is a failure on his part.
Alan, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Just have a minute left, but I wanted to ask you, one of the things I was surprised to read in your book is how the now president has changed his reading habits.
Yes. Well, you know, he used to read a lot of books, narrative, nonfiction, even fiction, and he ended up being a sort of such a wonk trying to, I think, study and impress Larry Summers, his personal economics professor, that he told me he was reading these dry policy tomes. Maybe that's also why he was so tired. He's not getting any sleep at night.
Richard Wolff, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Neil.
Richard Wolff is the author of Renegade, The Making of a President. He covered the Obama campaign from day one then Newsweek, then MSNBC, and a couple of other organizations along the way. Delighted to have him here. And Ken Rudin, as always, delighted to have you with us every Wednesday on the Political Junkie segment on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, Ken.
Richard, great book. That's a great book.
Tomorrow, Susan Boyle went from obscurity to worldwide celebrity overnight, celebrated, besieged by paparazzi, torn apart in print, and later hospitalized, all in the space of 2 months. Ted Koppel will join us for a look at the dark side of fame. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.